The Tom Woods Show, episode 2081.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Harry's, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, is offering listeners their starter set at harrys.com/woods. That's a 5-blade razor, a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover, a $13 value, all for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am so happy to have Dave Smith back on the program. Dave is the super popular host of Part of the Problem, and he's, of course, a stand-up comedian, you know that. I just got to see him this past weekend at the convention of the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania. And again, you do not have to be interested in politics or the Libertarian Party to find our conversations interesting. We talk about lots of things, Dave and I. And I want to talk to him just about the state of the world, in effect, and the state of the libertarian world and stuff like that. Whatever comes up, the Canadian trucker convoy, what the legacy of that was. Lots to talk about. It's been a long time since Dave's been on the show. So Dave, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. As always, very good to be with you. It was great seeing you and hanging out this past weekend.
I think it's, I don't know, when was the last time I saw you before that? It couldn't have been before COVID, or was it?
I think so. And even before, if you remember, before COVID, on your last trip to New York, we had plans to have lunch. And then my wife's grandfather, who was like 95 at the time, became very ill. I had to go out with her to go see him. And so I had to cancel our lunch plans on that last, like maybe the first week in March or something like that. It was like right before the COVID insanity hit. So yeah, it's probably been, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Porkfest. We hung out at Porkfest.
Oh, I saw you at Porkfest. That's right.
That's
okay.
Right.
I knew there was something. There had to be
there,
something.
There must have been something in there.
That was a lot of fun. But of course, yeah, we couldn't have known the significance of us missing that lunch in New York, that would be the last time New York would be, by New York standards, normal. And plus,
yeah, really
I was in
something.
New York like every 6 weeks. You know, we could have lunch another time.
Yeah. It was like, oh, I'm not going to catch it. Whatever. In a few weeks, we'll be right up here sitting in a restaurant having some lunch. No worries, you know? But that is not, those were famous last thoughts.
Right. Well, next month, I'm actually heading up there for a few days. And I haven't seen Gene Epstein in a very long time. I miss that guy. So we're going to have lunch at the Five Napkin Burger place, one of those locations, because that was where we had the last meal of normality in early March 2020. So we're going to resume.
Right.
There.
So that was the day before the day that we had lunch plans. I remember this because I remember Gene called me and invited me over there. And I was like, I can't do today, but I'm having lunch with Tom tomorrow. So, you know, I'll see him then. But yeah, what's really great is that today, as we're recording this, or I'm sorry, yesterday, they lifted all of the COVID passport restrictions to go to a restaurant. So you don't have to be vaccinated now to go to a restaurant.
Well, that's why, that's the only reason I would be going up there, is because they dropped that stuff or suspended it or whatever language they want to use. But I have friends who were there. And, you know, Gene is what, 76 years old? I don't expect Gene, who's lived in New York his whole life for all I know, to just pack everything up at age 76 and figure out how else to live his life. I'm not going to be crazy unreasonable. So I want to visit my friends. It's funny. I feel like I need to defend myself taking a trip to New York. I don't have to defend myself. There's nothing wrong with visiting friends in another city, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, I hardly think anyone could accuse you or I of not opposing the COVID regime enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've paid my dues.
I mean, you know, both of us have really dedicated our professional lives to opposing this over the last 2 years. And I don't know how many, you know, like podcasts and big platforms I've been on about this. You've put out a ton of material on this issue, huge speeches that went super viral before some of them, I guess, were taken down. So we've been focusing on this forever. This is, I think, the number one issue of our time, and it's just horrible and we should all be against it. But I do see some people being unreasonable about this stuff where it's like, oh yeah, you have some obligation to, even like you said, someone in their mid 70s has an obligation to leave their city. You have an obligation to not work with any of these businesses who are being coerced into this. It's, to me, there's a lot of holes in that type of thinking And it's like, do we really want to go down this path? I mean, we've all been paying our tax, or at least a lot of us have paid a lot of taxes, and we know what that funds. So, you know, it's impossible to ever, you know, like, I don't think because I put a mask on an airport so I can get to the next city, I'm somehow endorsing masking on airplanes. I just don't think that, to me, that's not like a workable attitude to have toward any of this stuff. So you have to do things like within reason. So I certainly support people like younger people who can pick up and move, leaving the cities. I think that's a smart idea. And I support people, you know, pushing back against this stuff, but I'm not going to like demonize somebody, especially someone like, you know, Gene Epstein, who I don't know. It's like, yeah, it really does suck that the venue he was doing it at was requiring vaccination status. They were also doing it under the threat of government force. And also, you know, what's the value of us all getting to watch Scott Horton just pummel Bill Kristol into the ground?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's pretty important.
Well, also, so you can hardly, I mean, you could hardly ask more of Gene. He opened up his own home to people and said, you don't need any vaccination proof to come to my house. And I have a gigantic video screen and we can all watch the debate together there. He's doing his best to keep community alive over there. You know, you mentioned all the content that I've been producing on this topic, which reminds me that yesterday's episode of the show, in which I talked about the morning I spent at the DeSantis roundtable, I couldn't put that on YouTube. I couldn't put that on my channel. Now,
right,
I don't do that many videos these days. Every once in a great while, I'll do a video. Usually, YouTube is just the audio of the podcast, but I might as well because I pick up a few extra thousand listeners that way. But it means they're missing all the juiciest ones because I'm on the verge of losing that channel. So I have to be super careful about what I put on. So I trust Dave Smith is acceptable to the powers that be at YouTube. So we'll put this one up. But yesterday's was a good one. And if you're listening on YouTube, you didn't get to hear it. So we're getting me up on Rumble. I'm already on Odyssey. I have a redirect link, tomwoods.com/vid. You can get all the complete uncensored collection of Tom Woods Show episodes. All right. You and I this weekend obviously were involved in helping out what's known as the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party, trying to bring libertarianism back to the Libertarian Party. And you've been posting quite a bit in the Facebook group about your travels and the conventions that you've gone to, the people that you've talked to, and the energy that you've experienced. And obviously not many of my listeners are in that particular Facebook group. So for the general public, can you share with us what you've been up to and what your experiences have been like?
Yeah. So, well, I've been going around to the state libertarian affiliate, you know, their state conventions. And I've been traveling to a whole bunch of them. So far, I've just in the last few weeks, I was in Arizona, California, Florida. We just did the one in Pennsylvania. This weekend, I'll be in Colorado. I'm going to be in Minnesota, Texas. I've got several more of them coming up. And it's been a very interesting experience. These are all like the official state Libertarian Party conventions. So there's a lot of different, you know, groups there. Justin Amash has been speaking at a bunch of them. Spike Cohen's been speaking at a bunch of them. Joe Jorgensen has been speaking. And everywhere I go, it's just been an overwhelmingly positive experience. I've had a great time at all of them. And I have not had one negative interaction with anybody. Not one. And it's just an interesting contrast from like what Liberty social media is like. And everywhere I go, the Mises Caucus guys just have the, like, it's everyone can see. They're the most energetic, most passionate, hardest working group. They've won everywhere, every single state that I've been, they've taken control of. And it's just kind of a beautiful thing to see. And one of the other things, which I'm sure you experienced too, over this last weekend, and you've experienced this at lots of different libertarian events, is that one of the things about social media, right, is that it kind of gives everybody a voice. This is both a positive and a negative effect of social media. And there's a very small group of people who try to make it seem like Tom Woods is this very controversial figure in the liberty movement, or Ron Paul is a very controversial figure in the liberty movement, or I'm a very controversial figure, you know, any of these. But as you see on social media, when they say that, you know, their post gets like 7 likes and then the person, you know, slamming them gets like 2,000 likes. So you can kind of get a gauge of it. But it's interesting to see that ratio come to life, and where you see that, like, you know, when you go out to these events, it's like thunderous applause and everybody's so thrilled that you're there. And you're like, well, this is, Tom is not a controversial figure in this movement. He's just a beloved figure in this movement. And there's something powerful about seeing that, you know, in person. And then I got to say, on top of that, one of the things that's also I've been really pleasantly surprised about is how much, you know, like the deranged maniacs who we deal with every now and then online, these aren't the people who are really like showing up to the Libertarian Party functions. And so even the older, you know, guard and the people outside of the Mises Caucus, they've all just been nothing but receptive to me. They've loved all of my talks and been really like supportive. And so it's just kind of interesting to see, you know, real life versus the kind of funhouse mirror version that you get on social media.
Donald Trump focused on a few major things. I mean, if you think back to what was he all about, he was unhappy about trade deals. He wanted to build the wall and maybe one or two other things. Okay, we all remember that. I mean, build the wall, you know, and Mexico's going to pay for it. We all remember the slogans. But if you asked him, what's your position on X, Y, or Z, he would tell you. But he focused on just a few things. And I think sometimes libertarians, because they feel like we've got this consistent philosophy and we want to tell the whole world where we stand on everything, that we tend not to focus on just a few things and really hammer them home. So if, let's say, you lived in a world in which Dave Smith were the libertarian nominee for president, would you follow that kind of a strategy? And if so, what would be your few issues that you would keep coming back to?
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. I would follow that strategy. And I think you're right that Trump's success is an example of that. But to me, the best example of a libertarian success, as always, is Dr. Ron Paul. And that Ron Paul, of course, no matter what you asked him, he would give you an honest answer and tell you how he felt. And of course, he was a true libertarian and understood the philosophy as well as anyone, and still does, as well as any living human being. But it wasn't as if what Ron Paul's campaigns were all about was like, I have this unified theory of ethical interactions between human beings, and let me explain the non-aggression principle. Like that wasn't what he was going to use the 2 minutes in a debate that he got to express. What he was going to tell you is why these wars were a disaster and how we could fix it, and why our currency was being destroyed and how we could fix it. He was going to address the crises that were facing the American people. And then once you kind of realized, wow, he really understands these and has some answers for them. How does he have these answers? It was like, oh, because I have this unified theory of, you know, social interactions and all of this stuff. So I think that should always be first and foremost. And honestly, I think that it's just so obvious what our focus should be. So first and foremost, it would be, you know, opposing the COVID regime. And this is the biggest liberty moment of our lifetimes. And there's this huge liberty movement right now kind of happening without libertarians. You know, the movement of people who are opposing all of the mandates and restrictions and lockdowns and passports and all of that stuff. So I think it's ripe for libertarians to kind of like take that. And this is the real tragedy of the LP not speaking up as me and you were during the height of the lockdowns and waiting till it was all over. So that's a big one. Of course, the other ones, I think, are still the Ron Paul issues. It's ending all of these wars. There's enormous popular support for that, especially right now with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. It's a great opportunity to talk about how dangerous interventionist foreign policy is, to re-question why we have these military alliances and these war guarantees with countries that really have very little to do with what any American in the middle of Arkansas really cares about or what's really affecting their lives. And then the really big one is the currency, because now all of the sudden, even though, as you know well and have talked about for years, monetary policy is supposed to be this issue that we don't really talk about. You know, you're just kind of like, we don't really talk about the Federal Reserve that much, really don't talk about the money. You just kind of take that as like, experts will figure this out and you need not worry your tiny little head about it. But right now, everyone is really focused on money, probably the most focused on it in my life. I suppose you could compare the financial crisis, but this is more specifically about the value of the dollar. And really, libertarians are the only ones who have anything to say about this. And so I think this is a really golden opportunity for us to talk about that. Of course, there's also a few other issues that those would be kind of like the A issues. And then right after that, I think it's important to talk about like the national security apparatus, the war on terror being turned inward toward the American people, police state issues that really are kind of behind the enforcement of the lockdowns and the mandates and all of this stuff. And I would add into the next tier there also the just rampant cronyism, you know, the trillions of dollars of bailouts to big corporations over the last few years. I think you put those things together, like here's what we stand for: an end to the COVID regime. We're going back to the old normal, the 2019 normal. None of this stuff. The vaccines are out there. People want to get them. They can. If not, that's their right. The government has no say in this. Ending all of the wars. We're not getting involved in other military conflicts. Everyone for the last 20 years has been nothing but a disaster. We're going to audit the Federal Reserve and, you know, insist on some type of sound money so that we're not destroying our currency. We're not putting billionaires on welfare and bailing out big corporations. We're demilitarizing the police. We're going to roll back this national security apparatus. That right there is a really powerful platform that super majorities of Americans can agree with. These are important issues worth focusing on. And libertarians have been talking about this forever. So we have a lot of credibility in this department. And I think that would be the start of the focus. And then, as you mentioned before, and then if anyone asks a question about anything else, you tell them the truth and have a compelling reason for why that's how you see things.
Hey, everybody, a word of thanks for our sponsor, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, Harry's. This month, dump the madness of your old expensive shaving routine by trying Harry's. Do what old Woods does. When I'm out of town and I have forgotten my Harry's razor, I go to a drugstore and get another Harry's razor. I don't go down to the little store they have in the hotel with the off-brand razors that are going to make my face a bloody mess. I need the close, comfortable shave of Harry's. And Harry's gives you the best of both worlds. You get a close, comfortable shave and a fair price. And in fact, Harry's blades are designed to stay sharp longer. In a recent study, guys who shave four times a week said their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. So that's a better experience with every shave and savings over time. So as you're starting your day, don't just listen to the Tom Woods Show. Be part of that Tom Woods community by using the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. And that is Harry's. Well, Harry's is giving their best offer to my listeners. New Harry's customers can redeem a starter set. You get a five-blade razor, a weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover to protect your blades when you're on the go. That's a $13 value for just $3. There's truly never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/woods to try Harry's today. One of the reasons that I referred to you over the weekend as the best communicator we have right now is that, yes, you're consistent. We know the expression about you being super consistent and all that. But beyond that, you can talk to ordinary people. Sometimes there is a tendency, again, because a lot of us are nerds or scholar types, we want to over-explain everything, or we're just nerds. We talk like nerds. We can't stop ourselves talking like nerds. It's like when you ask somebody into Bitcoin, can you explain Bitcoin to me? And right away, they're using words like nodes, and you've already lost everybody. To save their lives, they cannot explain this thing to you. And sometimes that's the case with libertarians. And it's because we're full of zeal. We want to tell everybody everything, and we want to explain every little nuance. And you just have this street corner, common sense approach that practically compels a person's assent when they listen to it. And it seems to me like that's the biggest gift you have, I think. And it's the most important gift for us to have right now.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I don't know if you're correct that I'm the best messenger we have. I would still say I think you are the best messenger
thank
we have.
Thank you very much.
I think there's people like Jeff Dice, you know, who are just like incredible. And to me, I still look at it like I'm a soldier and you guys are kind of my generals. And that's the way I look at it. But I appreciate you saying that, because that was always from day one, kind of why I got into being a libertarian personality and podcaster and commentator, because I always kind of felt like I'm just a regular guy who gets this stuff. And so I can explain this to other regular guys, like, hey, here's just the bottom line. Like, here's the regular guy take on this. And we have geniuses in the liberty world. And those people are great. I mean, thank God we have, you know, like David Gordon and people like that. You know what I mean? Like these geniuses who just do unbelievable work. But that's not really my role in this. I'm no genius, but I do get this stuff. And I think this is something that regular people should care about. That always just came natural to me. And then there is this other streak that runs through some camps in the libertarian world, where I think there's actually, and it's one of the things that I really detest about kind of the progressive Democrat establishment, and the Republican establishment as well, that there's like a real contempt for regular people. And I hate that. I really like regular people. I like working class Americans. I always have. That's just part of my personality, I guess. But I've always like, you know, like my father-in-law is a trucker. He's just like a great guy. I love him. I love all his trucker friends. And I, in many ways, feel more comfortable with them than I do with, you know, like academics. And I come from a family of academics. I love my family very much. But I just like, I know that world and I know the blue collar, you know, working class world. And I'm kind of more at home with them. I'd kind of rather like have a beer and watch a game with a trucker than have some highfalutin conversation with a professor at a liberal university. All of that just kind of comes naturally to me. And I find there to be a dynamic that's a problem within the libertarian world, where there are these people who kind of have these cultural preferences that ordinary blue-collar working-class people do not have. And, you know, they have contempt for their cultural preferences. And, you know, the problem with that is that if you're supposed to be fighting for those people's freedom, well, that also includes their freedom to live as they please. And if you have contempt, and not that you logically can't hold that position and be a libertarian, but you can see where that's kind of problematic.
Exactly. And as it so happens, I grew up in a blue-collar household. My father was a Teamster. He was a forklift operator in a food warehouse. But at the same time, and he didn't finish high school till much later, till he was in his 40s. But he was very self-conscious about this, that he didn't have the formal diploma. He didn't have the piece of paper. So he read constantly. So even though talking to him, you could tell he's a blue-collar worker. But yet the content of what he said, he was so widely read and so knowledgeable. He was a real inspiration to me. And so growing up with somebody like that, who genuinely craved knowledge, even though he didn't get it through the traditional channels, it's impossible for me to be contemptuous of working class people, even though I myself am not one. That's how I grew up. It's my whole extended family is how you would describe them.
Yeah, I love that. I bet I would have really loved your dad. I love guys like that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Same way, like my father-in-law is just like that. He's like a really super smart guy, and he knows the world. He knows things about the world. I mean, the guy's traveled everywhere, you know, throughout this country. He knows the country much better than, you know, some academic who had a 4.0 GPA or whatever, yeah. Like in a very different sense. And he's also a well-read guy. And I just think that there's a different type of knowledge and wisdom that you get from those types of people that I personally value more than kind of like just the college educated, typical person who repeats the dogma that they've learned in universities or whatever. So I think there's really something to that.
I don't know why I'm telling this story, but now I'm just thinking fondly of my father who died all the way back in 1996, but we lived in North Andover, Massachusetts, and the neighboring city was Lawrence. And when he would, once or twice when he drove by the Lawrence courthouse, he would roll his window down. All these people would be sitting outside the courthouse having a smoke, you know, waiting for their case to resume or whatever. My father would roll the window down and say, "I hope you beat the rap," and then just keep on driving. It was just such a strange thing to do. And then you might be too young to remember this, but in the 80s, the Meineke muffler people had an ad where somebody would come bounding into the Meineke establishment and say, "I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler." That was their slogan. "I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler." Well, one day, mom and dad are out at Denny's and my mother's breakfast came with an English muffin and she was about to eat it and she looked on the bottom of it. It was green. It was awful. I don't know what happened to it. So my father flagged down the waitress, points to it and says, "I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffin." I don't know. I love this guy. I love this guy so much. Now, you said the magic word trucker in what you said. So, you know, I listened to part of the problem. I kind of know what your opinions are. But looking at that in retrospect, what's your assessment of that trucker phenomenon in Canada?
Well, I think they had a big impact. And I think they really scared some of the, you know, ruling elite, let's say. And I think it was an important moment. And I feel bad that I think some of them probably have had their lives ruined. So it's something that if people are going to participate in, they should really go in with their eyes open and understand what they're getting involved in. And usually I am not a person who's like, "Yeah, let's get out and protest" or something like this. But at a certain point with this stuff, I do think it was necessary for the powerful people to feel how fed up the working class was. And it was almost a nice reminder to them of like how much you actually rely on these guys who do a very difficult, very thankless job. And I don't think it is a coincidence that we're seeing the rollback of so many of these mandates in such a short time span after these trucker protests. So I think they did humanity a real service, and I hope that too many of them didn't get their bank accounts seized.
Yeah. So much happened in such a short amount of time that some of the most dystopian scenarios that you would hear your really, really pessimistic libertarian friends describing to you as something that could happen, you say, oh, come on. I mean, look, I'm a libertarian too, and I don't like the state either, but none of this is ever going to happen to me. And then you watch what was done. These people are ruthless, what was done to ordinary people. So on the one hand, you see ordinary people, obviously, as you say, put the fear of God into them by standing up and basically being impossible to ignore. But then the state responded with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
But that was very important, though, in a way. I mean, I'm sorry that it happened to those people, but the silver lining is it woke us up in case we had any doubt of what these people are capable of.
Right. And, you know, there is something, right? This was like the Martin Luther King strategy. And I'm not trying, I know, you know, Martin Luther King is dead and people kind of lionize dead people. And Martin Luther King is not the perfect human being that people make him out to be. He had some political views that were horrible. He's like a socialist and stuff like this. And although he was very good on the Vietnam War, but focusing on maybe some of the good parts of what Martin Luther King did. And his whole strategy with those civil rights protests was, this is why they went to Birmingham, Alabama, right? Was that they knew they were going to draw this reaction and they kind of wanted the world to see it. And it's a very tough thing to see, you know, like black people in suits and ties practicing civil disobedience and dogs being, you know, sicked on them and like beaten by police officers. And for all decent people watching that to not go, geez, that's not what I support.
Yeah.
You know, you could imagine even kind of like an on the fence, yeah, I guess I support segregation because that's always the way it's been type of person looking at that and going, yeah, but I don't support that. You know? And so I think in some ways you do need these examples of how brutal the state is. And I think there's something that you mentioned there, you know, even as a libertarian, where we think about a lot of these things that a lot of people don't think about. And we think it's horrible when the state crushes people. But it's also very easy, whether you kind of intellectualize this or just kind of subliminally have this thought in your head, to go like, hey, I think it's really horrible what the government did to Ross Ulbricht. But I mean, I'm not creating any website where people can do whatever they want on the website, you know? So like, it's not going to happen to me. And like, hey, I think it's really horrible that they throw people, you know, for selling heroin in a cage for 30 years, but like, I'm not selling any heroin. So it just doesn't feel real. But then when you see it's like, oh, now they're cracking down on people who just want to go to work and raise their family. Like, it's not from the libertarian position morally. I'm not even saying it's a different thing, but just practically, that's a very different line. And you're like, wait a minute. Well, they do that to them. They could do that to anyone. I mean, it just feels different. And so in a lot of ways, I think that's kind of what happened throughout the rise of the COVID regime over the last 2 years is that, and I guess it's almost officially 2 years, they made it illegal to like open your small business. This is different than just criminalizing activity that people have been conditioned to accept as being illegal. Even things like pot use or something like that, that, you know, is a very like kind of largely agreed upon thing that is really no big deal, certainly nothing that warrants like going to jail over. But even things like that, you've just been kind of conditioned to accept like, well, some drugs are illegal, but like some jobs are illegal. Some people are deemed non-essential. This is like a whole different level where it feels a little bit closer to home. It feels like, oh, that I can't really say that couldn't happen to me anymore.
I remember the time when Alex Jones was deplatformed on several platforms almost simultaneously. And everybody, or a lot of people, laughed at him and thought, you know, good riddance, it's what he deserves. And he's a spreader of misinformation and all that, and we're well rid of him. And you might have been tempted to think, well, they do that to Alex Jones because he's a little bit out there. But there's no way that that's going to happen to me. You know, you might think, well, look, somebody like Woods, he's got an elite educational background. You know, he's not a dummy. They might disagree with him, but they got to keep him up. They do not, as it turns out. Well, and I'm also in this danger.
Well, that's right. And just to be frank about it, it's very easy to feel like, well, yeah, but Alex Jones is really sloppy. And you're not. You're really precise. You know what I mean? Like, you really don't just throw theories at the wall and claim them as absolute truth, which even though Alex Jones has gotten some things very right, he's gotten a lot of things very, very wrong and thrown a lot of wild theories out there. So it's kind of easy to say to yourself, it's like, well, I just won't do that, you know, and then I'll be protected. But then you realize that you're up there giving these presentations with like charts and data and giving the sources and explaining how it went from this and how the talking points were this and they told us this, but that's completely wrong. And look at these charts. This doesn't match what they're saying. And so there is this kind of innocent, almost like boyish quality that I still have a little bit of where you go, well, no one's going to kick that guy off because he's just telling the truth.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be right. That wouldn't be the right thing to do. But it's important for us to kind of wake up. And again, there's a different level where you can know this in your head, but it's a different thing to like know it in your soul and actually feel it. That it's like, no, they would do that to you too. They would do the same thing. And that's kind of how this deplatforming thing was able to, you know, slowly kind of incrementally ratchet up, is that it's easy to go like, oh, well, they booted this guy who's racist off, so I won't be racist. I'm not racist. That's not a problem for me. Then a bunch of people call you racist and you're like, oh, shoot. I guess it's happening to me now, you know?
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
you have this right. Like, you have this like thing inside you. You're like, but I'm not a racist, so this shouldn't happen to me. But, you know, you got to like get rid of that feeling because that's not going to do you any good. And I did, you know, I think both me and you probably did know this when it was happening to other people, but it's a very different thing to actually feel it and to see it happening to the good guys.
Yeah. It's very strange to be in this situation and feel like somebody who does good work and is honest and will admit to a mistake and all this, and to feel like I'm hanging by a thread on YouTube. I mean, I'll survive. If they drop my channel, I'll still survive. I've got other outlets, but it's still irritating. And I don't know who it was who put it to me this way, but talking about the 2008 financial crisis, somebody said, if we have a system that relies for its stability on wise regulators, we are in serious trouble, because the kind of person who becomes a regulator, I promise you, is not the person who graduated number one in his class. It just isn't. The guy who graduated number one in his class is the guy who runs rings around the regulators who graduated number 500.
Yep.
And for some reason, I'm put in mind of that because when I think about the people whose job it is to be fact checkers, I think about the regulators who graduated 500 in their class. The fact checkers are not the number one people. The fact checkers,
that's right.
Like when I've been fact checked, it's been so stupid. I mean, I've had articles where from time to time, somebody will come along and say, well, here's another way to think about what Woods is saying. And I'll think, well, all right, I don't agree with this guy, but that is a legit point of view. I look at these fact checkers and it's just an embarrassment. These are the people standing in judgment of me?
Yeah. No, that's right. And that's what's been so amazing. There's been like a few moments like this. I really thought when, not a fact checker, but just in terms of like how you look at the official narratives and what gets fact checked and doesn't. I mean, when Dr. Gupta from CNN was on the Joe Rogan Experience, I don't know if you saw that clip where he asked Joe Rogan whether he was going to get vaccinated or not. And Joe just goes, no, I just had COVID. He goes, I just had COVID and I just beat it. Why would I get vaccinated? And he was like, and he had nothing. He had no response to this. And he was like, well, yeah, you probably do have some immunity. And then Rogan's like, well, I have better immunity, right? Isn't that what all the studies show? I have better immunity than the vaccine. And he's like, well, yes, that's quite likely, but you know, you should maybe you'd get more immunity from having the vaccine. And he's like, but I have better immunity than the vaccine that you're pushing on people to get. So why do I need something more when what you're selling I already have better than? And he's got nothing. He's got no response. And you're sitting there, it's like this kind of crazy moment where you're like, okay, so you guys who have gone all in on everyone must get vaccinated, in fact, it's okay to ruin somebody, you know, cost them their livelihood, not allow them in a restaurant, not allow them in a sporting event, like not let them participate in society, really hurt people for not getting the vaccine. There's this whole class of people that represents what? I mean, millions of Americans that you have no reason for why they should get it. Like, I mean, that alone you're just like, that's pretty insane. And yet no fact checker is doing anything to like even raise these issues. And I mean, there's so much misinformation that's been out there. It's really something that we're the ones who get accused of spreading it when all of the most egregious misinformation has been spread from the establishment since the beginning of this thing.
That Gupta interview was a very, very important moment because it really supported our suspicion that these people don't have much in terms of,
yep,
do they really have all the arguments and the intelligence and whatever? No, they don't dare go up against one of our people. It's shocking that he went up against Rogan, that unprepared, that timid, that easily overwhelmed. They are paper tigers.
Yeah, and he led Rogan into bed. It's not even like Rogan brought it up. He asked him if he was going to get vaccinated. Like, are you not prepared for the obvious thing that he's going to say back to you? And this is where I was saying where I still have this kind of like boyish innocence in some way with all of this stuff, even though I know better, but it's still there to some degree. I mean, look, when Bill Kristol debated Scott Horton, I was still just blown away by how pathetic Bill Kristol's showing was.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this guy must have something. He's the professional neocon intellectual. He must have some type of argument for why it's better than it would have been with at least some of these military interventions. He just had nothing. He had absolutely nothing. And you're like, wow, it really is. It's kind of shocking. You still feel like in some childish sense that the quote unquote adults in the room must have something to offer. And it's really disillusioning and revealing to find out that it's like, no, they have nothing. They have nothing. And that's, by the way, also been my experience just being in the cable news circuit over the last, you know, like 6-7 years or whatever it's been now. It's like, it's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous that me, just some comedian who's just like, I don't know, read a bunch of libertarian stuff, that I can go on these things and just dominate these panels of supposed professionals. You know, it's not really like saying something so great about me. It's really just saying something really, you know, about how unimpressive so many of these people are.
That is the word. That is the word, unimpressive. Now, by the way, and I'm not in any way unhappy. This is fine. I'm not going to put this episode on YouTube either. You know why? Because you allege that natural immunity is superior to vaccine-induced immunity. Ugh.
And well, I suppose even though that's provable, you could leave that part out or something.
No.
It's just too risky.
I'm not going to censor myself.
Yeah.
I want the episode to go out the way we recorded it. But I have to last, I don't want to say the exact date. I have to last to a particular date without getting another strike. So,
and that's a great example though of just how crazy it is that you go like, this is something, it's not like my opinion on this.
It's not debatable.
Honestly, and I don't have a dog in this fight. Like, I would still feel the same way if it wasn't the case, you know, like if natural immunity was half as strong as the vaccine or something like that. Like, I'm just looking at what all of the studies have repeatedly shown, and it's clear. And yeah, you do, when you're up to the end of your strikes there, you do have to worry about stuff like this.
Yeah.
I had a tweet the other day. I really am like, you know, I try to not self-censor myself like on the podcast and stuff, but I am very careful with my platforms in the same way that you're like saying this now, like, okay, I won't put this up there, because it's like, you have to kind of constantly use, you know, this like cost benefit analysis and go like, okay, well, yes, I want to always tell the truth, but I also want to tell the truth to as many people as possible. And I don't see how it's particularly helpful for me to just lose my platform. Like, if I get kicked off Twitter, then I go, I got like 200,000 followers there now. Now I start from zero. It's like, well, now I can tell the complete truth without ever self-censoring, but to who? To not that many people. So I said to someone the other day on Twitter, I had a tweet responding to someone and I deleted it. But I said something, you know, they were advocating for fighting a war with Russia for Ukraine or something. And I said, well, you're more than welcome to pick up a gun and go join the fighting. And then as soon as I tweeted it, I realized like, oh, I just told someone to pick up a gun.
Yeah.
And now go I have join to wonder, fighting. Yeah. Now yeah. I was like, let me just delete that, because that could be taken in the wrong way, even though it's so obvious what I'm saying. But you do, it puts you in this position where you're like, oh, I got to be really careful about everything. Yeah. I hate that. That's not what I like. I like to not be careful.
Yeah, I hear you. It's very, very irritating and frustrating. But yeah, I'd like to hold on to it if I possibly can. But as I say, the way I'm handling that is just, I'm just releasing the episodes to the usual channels. And I've kind of urged people not really to use YouTube for this purpose, you know, so I don't have to do this. Go over to the alternative video sites, or better yet, just use a podcasting app, and then we don't have to worry about this. Because so far, podcasting does seem to be an area of the internet where you can still say what you want.
Yeah.
And they're not taking it down, except in very, very unusual circumstances.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, thank God we still have that for now, because that's kind of, I think, in some ways, like the final frontier right now of what we still have. You can still get on a microphone and say what you want to say and be relatively, relatively safe. Although, as you said, there are some examples where people have been kicked off like iTunes and stuff like that. And that's a really scary prospect if that becomes normalized.
Yeah. Or you would hear somebody being kicked off PayPal and you'd think, wow, that person must be a really crazy extremist. But now, again, the word is normalized. That kind of thing is becoming normalized because now we're seeing that an entire country can just be shut off from this, that, or the other thing. Jeez, could you imagine how Americans would be reacting if we had been cut off for invading Iraq and everybody around the world had little Iraqi flags and stuff? And I wish they had had the guts to do the Iraqi flag thing. I wish the Simpsons characters had had the stones to do that, which of course they don't.
Right, right.
And to think, oh, well, that's just because Russia's a bad person. Well, that's like saying, well, Alex Jones was deplatformed because, you know, he's not a nice guy and he's a conspiracy theorist. So therefore, I don't have anything to worry about. This is all a trial run to be tested out on you someday, dear listener.
Yeah. And I mean, look, is there any better example than the war on terrorism being turned inward domestically to target who? Right-wingers. It's the same people who we were arguing with, you know, 15 years ago about how we need to support the war on terrorism. And now those same guys who were championing it, because of course this is targeted toward those Muslim terrorists. You know, there's never a thought in their head that this could turn around and be targeting them. And maybe there's a lesson there for the Democratic voters who are supporting this now. You know, don't think it's so crazy that this could be targeting you at some point. So that is something to keep in mind.
No kidding. Well, take a minute to tell people about Part of the Problem.
Well, Part of the Problem, that's my podcast, of course. And you can get that, at least for now, wherever you get podcasts. And I would just say also, because I'd rather just take a minute and just tell people more about what the Mises Caucus is doing that I really think is just so incredible. I'm really so excited about this because this was a project that me and you got involved with a few years ago. And everything is really coming together right now. Like we're in the center, we're in convention season. And it's not just like the Mises Caucus has become, you know, a force in the Libertarian Party. It has become the force in the Libertarian Party. And I'm just so excited to have this Libertarian Party actually represent what we want it to represent, which is like the true liberty movement in the tradition of Murray Rothbard and Ron Paul and Tom Woods and Scott Horton and all these just like great people. But we really want to, you know, I really miss the days when we kind of had a seat at the table and we had a guy who was out there representing our views. And right now is the time to come be a part of it if you're not already. And on top of all of that, it's just so much fun. It's like some of the best people that you'll meet. You'll have so much fun coming out to these events and stuff. And there are still, in some states, I believe you can still become a delegate at this point, if you want to. I'd highly recommend everybody go to lpmisescaucus.com and just put in your information there, connect with these guys. It's a great time. You're fighting for something important. It's a lot of fun. And I've met just some great friends that will be lifelong friends of mine from this whole experience. And we're going to do this all the way up to Reno. And really, you know, it's just going to be so great once Angela McArdle is the chair and we've kind of accomplished this mission of bringing the Liberty Movement into the Libertarian Party and grabbing the steering wheel. And I'm really excited about what's coming in the next few years.
All right, everybody, check out Part of the Problem. I listened to Part of the Problem, so you should also listen to Part of the Problem. Just in case you don't have enough Tom Woods Show episodes, there are plenty of episodes of Part of the Problem that you can check out. I'll put some links up at tomwoods.com/2081. Thanks a lot, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Tom. Always a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Before we wrap up, a little update on something. You remember I had a big announcement? Well, just over a month ago, I'm recording this in March. I guess this is March 9th that this episode's coming out. So just over a month ago, I launched, at the urging of Jay Abraham, who's a legendary business strategist, something called the Tom Woods School of Life. In fact, that very name was recommended to me by him. And the school focuses on practical things. So we're not talking about the non-aggression principle or economics or philosophy, as important as all of those things are. It's about how to prosper and thrive in a world that hates you. And man, the hatred the elites have for you becomes more brazen every day. So first month of my School of Life, we talked about personal finance, getting your budget in order. We talked about investing. This month, we're talking about relocation. So the first live session for this month is going to be with Doug Casey, who's the number one New York Times bestselling author and investor who's lived in 10 countries and visited 175. And he's going to talk to us about international relocation, second passports, offshore accounts, stuff like that. Our second session in March for my members is on relocating within the U.S. And so I'm going to have people from Tennessee, Florida, Texas, New Hampshire, Arizona talking to us. The person talking to us from Tennessee is former U.S. Congressman John Duncan, who was the last Republican opponent of the Iraq War to retire. Then our final session this month will be with Joel Skousen, who's an expert on relocation. He's the author of the massive book, Strategic Relocation. So it helps that I know everybody. I can bring these people on, have live sessions with my people, and get all their questions answered. I'm also about to release a 4,000-word report for my members on how to relocate on a budget. We've just added a business directory so we can support each other's businesses. About time libertarians started doing that. A job board so we can hire each other. About time libertarians started doing that. And a directory of local events so my members can meet each other. And speaking of which, I'm going to be paying for an optional in-person event for my members in Orlando in July as one of the many unannounced bonuses they get. So yeah, you could say that's an important project. And that's a project on which these folks were lucky to get in on the ground floor. We reopen in August. Hop on the wait list. The website is tomschooloflife.com. Get on that wait list and be a part of this thing. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.